To the cloud. All right, and we're recording, and I'm going to share screen. All right, welcome everybody to the Node Builder workshops for OpenIDL. Today is Monday, May 15th. This is the first kickoff session for the Node Builder workshops. As with all Linux Foundation meetings, this is held under the Linux Foundation antitrust policy. If you have any questions about these matters, please contact your company counsel. Or if you're a member of the Linux Foundation, please feel free to contact Andrew Updegrove of the firm Gesmer Updegrove LLP, which provides legal counsel to the Linux Foundation. Janko and Svetan, you can absolutely share your screen at any time. And I'm going to turn it over to Jeff to address the assembled before we start.
Yeah, I just want to thank everybody for joining this initial session. Glad this has been recorded for those that can't attend. And I think it's a great opportunity for the community to expand awareness of itself and learn some good stuff from the Sanofi team. So I just would like to welcome you all and turn it over to you, Svetan and Janko.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff. I'll be sharing the screen just, guys, before we proceed. Let me know if you see the slides.
It looks good.
All right. So I can actually all of those things will be shared to you on the wiki. First of all, welcome everyone. My name is Svetan Georgiev. I'm with the Sanofi team, and in the past couple of months, we've been working hard on making some improvements on the deployment process of OpenIDL on AWS in particular, but we also do have some tips and tricks to bring that up on Azure as well, and in the future on any other cloud provider, hopefully, so we could support actually more environments and infrastructures for any type of carriers that may want to join the OpenIDL network. So we'll continue with the goals of the whole workshop. There'll be a bit of learning curve that we need to go through, and that's essentially to understand the basics, what we are dealing with, and essentially understand what OpenIDL components are and what an OpenIDL means. There'll be a bit of, it's a catch-all kind of a phrase, OpenIDL node. You may think about as a single server running somewhere. It's more complicated than that. When we refer to an OpenIDL node, we mean a bunch of components, applications, Hyperledger Fabric nodes, peers that were run on a particular infrastructure, representing a single carrier or analytics node. We'll be talking about those types of OpenIDL nodes in a while. So once we set that understanding, we will move to actually to configure and deploy the OpenIDL carrier node. We already do have some on the open existing OpenIDL network, an analytics node running. So we'll be reusing that for the workshop. But the goal is actually for you guys to be able to configure and deploy a carrier type of node on your local infrastructure. And of course, what we want to achieve is to join those newly bootstrapped nodes on the OpenIDL network. We'll be able, hopefully, to start seeing each other nodes and jump on the network, do something there, like creating a data call maybe, and just to see how the data goes through the established channels between the nodes on that you have on your own infrastructures. All right, so to go through the session schedule quickly, there'll be in total 3 weeks, 4 weeks actually of sessions. It's just in the slides for your information. I won't go into every single detail of every single session right now. We will be doing that throughout the next weeks and days. So there is just a bit of how how long we think it will take. Take that as a guideline rather than a set in stone timing. So we'll try to be as flexible as possible to help you go through all the steps throughout the next few weeks. So we will be starting with setting up some infrastructure, some tools that we'll be using to deploy the node. Then we will be going through the deployment of the so-called Fabric Operator, which is an open source tool provided to us by Hyperledger community that will enable us to manage, operate, and deploy the Hyperledger piece of the OpenIDL node. And moving forward, we will be dealing with creating those secure communication channels between the nodes so they can start talking to each other. And the last step is going to be to deploy the OpenIDL applications. Right. So all the questions, actually, I have a dedicated slide at the end. So if you have any questions, let's do it after. So I just want to go through the things right now. If you don't understand something or have something in mind, just wait until we cover everything, and then we will start the questions and answer piece of part of the session. So next step is going to be to give you an introduction to OpenIDL node. I know that many of you already know what it is. I'm doing it here just for a reference, so we make sure that we are all on the same page. I'm trying to do it kind of in a visual way with diagrams, so it can you can better understand what it is that about. So we'll be talking about the OpenIDL Consortium. I'll show you a bit of the applications, what they look like for those of you who haven't seen them so far. And we'll be focusing also on what a carrier node components look like and what are the deployment steps to get a carrier node up and running on a particular infrastructure. Okay. Good. So the OpenIDL Consortium, it's the diagram you're seeing here, the fancy one, shows a network of three nodes. As you see, we have on top the analytics node, and down there we have the two carrier nodes. So those nodes, as I explained, may run on different infrastructures. That's why you have AWS and Azure here. It could be another cloud provider. Of course, technically it's possible. Actually, what is even further possible is to have a node running on across different cloud infrastructure. If you have by any chance any mixture of cloud providers you're using at your company, that's also possible. Essentially, all the deployment is done based on Kubernetes. It's deployed on those infrastructures and. Essentially, the OpenIDL applications, the Hyperledger Fabric peer, which is the blockchain part of the solution, is deployed on Kubernetes, and Kubernetes is used as a local network orchestrator of the deployments of the OpenIDL applications and peers. Of course, we also deal with the Hyperledger Fabric nodes here that we will be explaining down the road. You may not know the details or may not fully understand Hyperledger Fabric as a technology, but I hope down the way we will be able to provide further details so you can get better understanding what it is and how it works. So essentially, you see that those three nodes, it's just a reference. Of course, we do expect to have way more carrier nodes on OpenIDL. It is just an example now with two. But essentially, we have a communication channel that is actually a Hyperledger Fabric channel where the information and all the business part of the applications actually exchange. This is, think about it as the business transactional data being exchanged between the different nodes on the network. Of course, those public so-called messages contain data that can be shared between all the nodes on the network. And of course, we do have some private communication channels that are used to share privately data between the carrier and the analytics node. Think about it like the analytics node in my case, even though we may have multiple analytics nodes, in my case, I have one with two carriers connected to it. So essentially, data is pushed from the carrier privately to the analytics node. So there is no essentially visibility or sharing of the private data between the carriers themselves. They might be competitors and whatnot. So for business and security reasons, they do not communicate or share any of those any piece of that private data that's being shared with the analytics node to create at the end of the day a report. To extract the data and create a report. So the next thing is a diagram of what the application deployment usually looks like. So here you can see that we have the same kind of setup with two carrier applications that are exposing a user interface. And I'll show you that in a minute, what it looks like. So the users of the particular carrier analytics node being like for analytics node, we have the regulator, for example, or the stat agent who's doing signing and creating extraction patterns and assigning them to data calls. And we have the carrier users who are actually responding to those data calls in order to trigger an extraction of the data and send it privately to the analytics node. And as you see here, there is the process is orchestrated within Hyperledger Fabric deployment and a bunch of, it's actually a chain code that is dealing with that. And the data is being extracted from the local instance it's being extracted by the within the carrier node from its local harmonized data store that is currently working with an SQL database and Postgres in particular. And it is being pushed through a private channel to the analytics node. Okay, so the next one, I'll show you a bit of the, let me just move that, see if I have access, perfect. So I'll share, just let me see. It is, what you're seeing right now here is essentially the user interface of one of the carrier nodes that are currently deployed as part of OpenIDO network. And we already have some test data there. And I'll just show you the UI so you can get a better understanding what the user interface looks like from business point of view. Just let me get the credentials to log in. Second, I am in one of the carrier, which is named Carrier One. Have in mind all of those carriers. We have like two of them on that network. They run into their own dedicated AWS accounts. Right, so I have to take the Carrier One. Take the user. And so as you see here, we have already a bunch of data calls being created for the purpose of extracting some test data from the HDS for the carrier, which is carrier one. So Peter, you are the rock star today because we named them after you, by the way. So we have the extraction pattern here that's been attached to the data call. And as you see here, that the we have also view of the carrier consent that's been given to that data call, which essentially extracts what's happening at that point is that it extracts the data from the local HDS of the carrier and sends it securely to the analytics node as a response to the data call. And the extraction pattern itself is essentially a, you can download it here. It is essentially a file that is an SQL. So we use an SQL to extract the data from the local harmonized data store of the carrier. Okay, now, of course, as I explained, that is the view for the carrier. We also do have the analytics node, which is another, let me just copy the, okay, take the other endpoint. As you see, that's a completely dedicated endpoint, dedicated account, AWS account where the analytics node is running. Take the user and the password. And that is essentially the view, the same view on the data, but essentially that is the view of the analytics user. Okay. So essentially you're seeing the same data. Of course, you can perform different actions like the analytics user can create a new data call, whereas the carrier is just consenting to a data call received and created by the analytics user. Okay, so going back to the slides, what we will be covering next is the internals of the carrier node, and that's what we will be deploying. It sits in our case into the AWS account, and we will be doing that with some of you guys on the call on Azure. So I'm looking forward to making that happen and connect that to the rest of the network. That would be a significant achievement for all of us. But essentially, the components that we will be deploying inside will be mainly the same. And of course, there will be a bit of difference because of some native cloud providers to cloud tools that we will be using, like let's say the DNS, the Route 53 in AWS is, I think, in Azure, it's named DNS Azure, something like that. So as you see, it's different naming, but their purpose is almost the same, essentially to maintain the DNS records of the nodes so we can expose them on internet and they can connect to each other. Essentially, what we are having within the context of a single carrier node is a bunch of Kubernetes clusters. So essentially, we have three Kubernetes clusters. The reason we have three is because of separation of concerns and actually just to make sure that the data is isolated and secured within their own bubble, let's put it that way. So we have the ops cluster, which is the cluster where we have the OX, which is the open source version of Ansible Tower project. And we use it to orchestrate and to execute the Ansible scripts that are actually utility scripts to deploy resources and to deploy components and to create, of course, some resources on the cloud without us having to do that manually, because obviously without automating, it will take much longer than having an automated script to execute for those steps. And we have Jenkins as a deployment as well. We will be configuring and using both of them. So that essentially is the first step that we will be covering. We also do use a Terraform cloud. So this, some of the prerequisites, we'll be going through those prerequisites at the end, by the way, just to make sure that we all understand what it is and get ready for the first session. Terraform, there are Terraform scripts that are being used, and those Terraform scripts keep their state on the Terraform cloud. it's much easier to work with them. Essentially, those Terraform scripts are deploying the Kubernetes clusters that are right here in the center. And we have two Kubernetes clusters. One is for the applications. Essentially, that's kind of a best practice. So we keep the applications separated from the Hyperledger Fabric deployment itself and the business transactions and data. And essentially, the applications connect to HDS, extract data, push that information to Hyperledger Fabric so it can be securely shared and communicated to the analytics node, for example. And the next Kubernetes cluster here is purely used for Hyperledger Fabric deployment, where we have things like Hyperledger Fabric peer, Hyperledger certificate authority. We could also use Prometheus deployment to actually collect metrics and eventually push them to a metric for analytics on Grafana, for example. It can be integrated with Grafana out of the box as well. So this is more or less the very high level what's inside those Kubernetes clusters, what's inside in general in a carrier node. So what we're gonna do? That's another view. So there are a bunch of steps here. Every one of those steps have their own meaning and their own purpose. So of course, one of the most important, and I would say the heavy lifting, is actually to provision the infrastructure. That's essentially assuming we start with a blank AWS account, and we get to a point where we have all of those Kubernetes clusters provisioned. After we call it like the infrastructure as a code. Then we have the steps to deploy the applications, right? So to deploy the application, we use Ansible, Ox, as I just explained, to orchestrate the scripts, the Ansible scripts, so we can deploy the Fabric operator, which is a native Kubernetes component and will allow us to deploy, bootstrap, manage, operate, do whatever we like with Hyperledger Fabric in very intuitive way using the web-based interface of the Hyperledger Fabric operator. Essentially, that process of managing the network, it's a continuous process. It doesn't end after we deploy and join our node on the network. And the reason for that is, imagine tomorrow you want to join another carrier on the network. So there are a bunch of security policies that may require the existing carriers on the network to consent on adding new carrier, right? So when someone is jumping on the network, you kind of should be agreeing to that to happen. So it is essentially related to the governance process of the network, and we will be seeing that as well towards the end of the workshop. And here, the next step is actually essentially another view of the same thing, what we're gonna do. So all of those steps will be covered into dedicated sessions. So essentially, we will start with provisioning a Kubernetes cluster to deploy Jenkins and Ox. Then we will use Jenkins to essentially deploy, create the Kubernetes clusters that will host the applications and the Hyperledger Fabric piece of the OpenIDL node. So we'll be doing a lot of configuration on the Terraform, Jenkins, and we'll be running the jobs, and hopefully if everything is working fine, we will be having those Kubernetes clusters up and running and ready for us, of course, to deploy the Fabric operator. So after we do the Fabric operator, we go to the next step, which is to create the Hyperledger Fabric nodes. Here, I guess, will be a bit of learning for all of us to understand the steps of what it means to create the Hyperledger Fabric peer, a certificate authority, and how essentially we create a node that later on we will be adding to the network. And essentially, we will be also doing using the Hyperledger Fabric Operator console to perform actions like deploying the chain code, which is, think about it as the business logic that's driving the OpenIDL transactions. And we'll be using it after that to join our peers on the Hyperledger, on the existing OpenIDL network. And the last step will be to deploy the applications that will give us the nice user interface to actually see what's on the network and, of course, consent on data codes. Okay. Now, what we won't be doing here is to set up essentially and fill the HDS with data. That's going to be another exercise that is not within the scope of this workshop. Okay. Good. So I hope I managed to give you a bit of an overview. So we'll be going to questions. So please, if you have any concerns or anything, go ahead.
Hi,
this is, go ahead.
Hi, this is Adam from the Hartford. Apologies, I'm losing my voice. On one of the diagrams, you showed an interaction, I believe it was between AWX and Terraform. We normally have like Enterprise Jenkins install trigger Terraform because though it was set up to have authentication to kind of run Terraform jobs that are trusted to deploy to AWS and trigger Ansible Tower and so on. Where like if we put AWX in the container, I don't know if we would have that same level of access to Terraform Enterprise.
Okay. So, Janku, if you want to answer that, go ahead.
So, Adam, your concern is that you cannot use Jenkins from within the Kubernetes cluster. Your enterprise Jenkins account. Is that what you're saying?
No. Normally, if we want to run a Terraform workflow, we have to trigger that from Jenkins using like an approved Terraform workflow that's pre-configured for like authorization to actually run the plan and deploy. I don't know if that would fit into like the AWX calling Terraform model, or just kind of what your thoughts are on that.
Mm-hmm. So one thing is that we will be installing our own, diagram here, right? We'll be having a dedicated Kubernetes cluster where we'll be installing our own dedicated Jenkins and Ox instances. Right. So we'll be able to configure them. By the way, that's AWS specific. If we are deploying on any other cloud, none of this is relevant. It's just because the scripts are tailored towards AWS, not any other cloud provider. So for now, that's specific to AWS.
Okay. I think I can phrase it in a different way then. What level of access would these like Jenkins and AWX jobs deployed inside of our EKS cluster need to Terraform Cloud?
Well, essentially we don't need to use Jenkins. I think what we can do is probably we can bundle the script that executes the Terraform scripts over and execute it as a shell command from your client machine. Jenkins is, I think this is the only step that we're still using Jenkins for. Again, we can, bundle it into a shell script if that makes it easier. In terms of what permissions Terraform Cloud needs, well, it depends on the user that has been configured as an AWS access key and secret key, right? So this will give you the permissions that, and this is part of the prerequisites, what we need in terms of that user to have access.
Is Terraform Cloud required, or can Terraform, what are they called, Enterprise be used instead?
I mean Terraform Cloud, not Enterprise. Just one that we need like a password to the non-local install. So I'm following so far.
We run locally.
We prefer to use cloud though, honestly.
Yeah, my question is I think some other carrier might have said that they would use Terraform Enterprise instead of Terraform Cloud. That's why I guess it wasn't yours. But I definitely have talked to somebody who said, yeah, I don't think we'd use cloud. We would use enterprise because that's what we have inside our company. I'm speaking for somebody and I don't even remember who I'm speaking for. So,
yeah. So we don't necessarily have access or experience with Terraform Enterprise just because we're using the open source and the free.
Right.
But I assume that they would be very close to functionality and it should be possible to use both editions.
Okay, so my other question is that you're showing three Kubernetes clusters. Does that add significant cost to have them separated as three different clusters, or is that just a way to configure inside EKS?
So we chose to use Kubernetes to install Ox and Jenkins just because it follows the same paradigm as deploying all the other components in OpenIDL. For the sake of costs, yes, you can bundle everything in one Kubernetes cluster. Again, you're sacrificing some flexibility and also posing security concerns. Of course, those could be addressed, but for the sake of doing the workshop and performing all the actions required, we are setting everything up on different Kubernetes clusters so that we follow the current documentation.
Yeah, no, I'm not challenging that. Yeah. I'm just. But my understanding was that EKS was a major part of the cost of this stack. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I thought was true.
Yeah, it is.
Well, yeah, EKS adds some licensing fee for every Kubernetes cluster, which roughly is around $100 per month per cluster.
Right, when you're talking about 700 total stack, that's 3/7 of the cost.
Yeah,
part of the reason I think that the different clusters were used is based upon the observation that if there's a problem in a single cluster that also contains the network nodes, it impacts the network itself, and that was why the application cluster was separated from the
fabric. Yeah, no, I get the separation of concerns. I'm just raising the different angle that's a significant difference in cost than one cluster. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. It's possible to deploy on one cluster, as Janko mentioned. Okay. We've done this a few times during. We have that dev network. And yeah, we've done this on the same Kubernetes cluster. So that's an option, of course. But again, as we explained, we want to follow the guidelines that we have as of now in place for security and availability reasons.
Cool. Thanks.
Okay. Hey, Adam, did that address your concern about the Terraform and Jenkins?
It does for the purposes of keeping along with the workshop. It's the local execution will be a path forward. How we do it in the long term, we'll talk about. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Want to make sure we're good.
All right, any other questions? All right. If something comes up, just interrupt. Okay, so what we're going to do next as a follow-up is essentially, as I already explained, is to get that Ops Kubernetes cluster up and running where we will be installing Aux and Jenkins. Essentially, that's the very first step. It's a bit time-consuming and boring, but we have to go through it. It's a bit of fun, though. Of course, we have some prerequisites because we will be needing some tools and access some command line tools and libraries being installed on your command machines so we could operate, connect to Terraform, execute scripts, and do all those things. Janku may explain in a minute in more details what's needed. Actually, we built a page where you can see all those prerequisites. Essentially, it is not just the command line interface tools that we'll be using. There are also other things like the images that we are using, because those images are part of different repositories, just to make sure that your internal instance and infrastructure have access to those repositories. You can find also the link to the workshop wiki page, and we also have a deployment guide for the network. We will be using, it's a documentation, it's a wiki page with documentation with the steps and description of the things, why we're doing it, and so on and so forth. That we will be heavily using throughout the workshop. And of course, we will be changing, adding things just to make it more clear, depending on the feedback and feedback on the steps that we will be executing in the next few weeks. So we'll take our chance to improve the documentation as we go. So that is an important link that you need to know going forward, so we can get a reference to the steps, actually details of the steps that we'll be doing. So Janku, I'll let you explain the prerequisites. Okay, I'll just open it up. And you could go through them. Let me just make that larger so you can all see.
Okay, thanks, Susan. So I suspect that almost everybody has gone through the list, but we'll just cover the basics. If you have any questions or concerns, feel free to raise your hand or just speak up. But essentially, our focus for this workshop is AWS in terms of, just because that's the current tooling is working on AWS. But as we have some participants on Azure, we can cover that in the workshops, and also help you out with any additional steps or questions. But when we go through the workshop, we'll be following the documentation, which is on the wiki. The first step is to have an AWS account. Of course, ideally, we would like that account to be on its own and provisioned only for OpenIDL, but that's not a must. It's just for organizational purposes and also, you know, making it easier and more secure to make changes in a more secure in kind of environment, so we don't affect any other components. But either way works, as long as we have a user that can manage IAM users and roles, we should be fine. And then as soon as we have that user, the first step in the workshop would be to create that user through the access key and secret key that has been provisioned to you by the IT department of your company. If you don't have one, maybe now it's a good time to request that user. If there's a problem with that, I think this might take longer time for some companies to provision. So please go ahead with it. Tomorrow we'll have the office hours, so please come forward if you have any concerns about that. So this is the IAM user. So Tan, if you could browse a little bit down. So in terms of the network, we would need a public access to the internet through port 443. So we've talked to a couple of participants already, and as it should be, insurance companies, you know, are secure and they have strict policies. Unfortunately, we cannot get around building a network without having a public access from node to node, because that's the nature of the network. So we have to make sure that port 443 is open for communication over TLS. The only public communication that's going to be done is going to be through the Fabric, the Hyperledger Fabric component, and that would be encrypted and secured communication. So there isn't any security concern with that. There's some other endpoints that we'll be using, which could be internal to your network, but they're not essential to building the network. So in a way, we could have a private network where we can access your tooling, such as AWX, Aux, and Jenkins through your VPN. But for the network, we need 443. Then we also need a Terraform Cloud account. This is free. You don't necessarily need to pay for Terraform Enterprise or any paid service around that. We're using a free account that gives us the ability to create workspaces. And those workspaces contain the data for your infrastructure components in AWS. So it is very important that this account is, you know, has a strong password, you know, follow the guidelines for Terraform Cloud on creating the account. Keep the password secure, and if it's not provisioned by your IT department. The operating system. We've been using Linux and Mac OS. We're not saying that it wouldn't work on Windows, but just from our own perspective, we haven't done, you know, thorough testing on Windows, even though all those tools that we'll be using are, they have their own, you know, packages for Windows. But either way, we prefer to use Linux and Mac OS. And as I mentioned previously in some other discussions, we prefer to have a virtual machine on Windows rather than working on Windows right away, like directly. And then we have the open source software that we need to have installed on your operating system. The first one is Terraform. That's fairly important just because we'll be using it to start the infrastructure. So we need that client on the machine in order to be able to communicate with Terraform Cloud. TerraGrant is just a tool that's a wrapper on top of Terraform. We have a couple of components that that use TerraGrant just to make the configuration easier. So install pretty much, I mean, there are links on those prerequisites, on those tools. So please install your version of the software based on the guidelines of each tool out there. So we can work with the latest version, I believe. If we run into any issues, I guess we'll have to install particular versions, but I believe those tools are pretty, they can work with backwards compatible versions of what was built, what we have in our repositories, so we should be okay with that. Kubectl is for Kubernetes. We have also AWS client that we need to install. Python is important. I believe that should be coming along with some of the other tools that you're installing if you don't have already Python, because Linux usually does have Python installed, but just in case if you need to install it. And then we have Helm, which we are using in some places to install some of the Helm charts, such as Aux and Jenkins. The rest of the open source components that you see down there, they're not necessarily something that you can install or you should install on your client machine. Those are just references for what we use as open source software. So prerequisite number 7, all those repositories are public, so there's no access required. As we go, we'll be pulling the latest from those repositories. We'll let you know what branch you need to use. This is just informational. There's no any action item on your side. And number 8, this is the Docker repository access. We got to know that in some companies there is certain limitations on using open source Docker repositories. Unfortunately, we built the solution on using open source Docker repositories, but we'll work with your IT department constraints, and we'll try to make this work as much as possible. We've tried to list the more important containers or images that you see here, but it's possible that we may have missed some of them, so we'll have to go based on what we find in the process of building the infrastructure. This would give you some guidelines on what are the images that will be coming our way in order to install the solution. And then the last prerequisite is we have tested the solution on Kubernetes 1.24. So that's one of the later versions, not necessarily the latest, but we'll try to use that version in order to keep things stable for the time being, because every version needs to be totally tested before we upgrade. But yeah, hopefully your organization allows that version of Kubernetes. So that's in a nutshell of all the requirements that we have, all the prerequisites. And tomorrow, if you have any problems with any of the tools, ideally you should have them installed, especially the clients. Those client applications, those should be installed. And if you have any issues with those, just let us know.
A quick question. Did you say Kubernetes 1.24 or 1.24 plus?
Well, Yeah, ideally, I know I said plus in the requirements, but I think we should probably fix it and say 124 is what we need to use. I'll update that wiki page and I'll remove the plus, but yeah, I think we should use 124.
Gotcha, thank you.
So Aim, you're paying attention, that's good.
Well, just on that, you know, that's 1.27 is out and they only are, I think they only support one or two back, N minus two. I don't know if they support 1.24 as much anymore. Well, that's fine.
Those versions, they come very often. As Janko mentioned, usually when we upgrade, we test and all that. So we haven't tested with the later version. There is very high chance that it's going to be just fine. But at that point of time, we cannot guarantee it will be right. So it's more of a rule of a thumb kind of approach here. So that's why 1.24. That's it.
This information is great, actually, because now we've got, you know, all the major components and their version. So this is very helpful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And the procedures for upgrading to new versions of the lower level infrastructure will be another exercise that OpenIDL will try to conduct once we have gotten through the basic steps of getting, you know, nodes set up with a stable version, because mm-hmm. that will be something that we will have to coordinate going forward anyway.
Yep, there are different levels of upgrades depending what we are upgrading. So we'll have to define those paths and some governance on top just to make sure we don't affect the operation of the network.
Yeah. And just as an observation, because there will be a number of people and different organizations participating, typically those types of upgrades are few and far between over the course of the year and well planned.
Yeah.
So okay. To confirm, we're supposed to come into Wednesday the 17th at 3:30 Eastern and have all this stuff set up and ready to go?
Yeah.
Ideally, yes. I mean, you can probably try to do it in the span of the workshop, but you may fall behind with the steps and it will be harder to catch up after.
Okay.
So it's better just those tools here, just bring Linux or can install them to start with.
And have all the open source stuff installed and have your AWS account and your user mm-hmm. set.
Yep. Another thing again to stress on is the domain name, right? So you need to make sure you have some subdomain dedicated for the instance that we'll be deploying and we'll be using that subdomain for all the endpoints that we'll be exposing. So as you see, we have multiple endpoints here, right? We have the applications, we have the Hyperledger Fabric peers, the certificate authorities, and the Fabric operator console, and many more. So we will be needing those DNS names, the domain available for us to configure to route the traffic to the appropriate Kubernetes cluster where the applications and containers will be running. Okay, so just make sure you have a domain in hand to be used. It could be whatever you have available. Don't worry about the, there is no concrete guideline on what your domain should look like. But usually, for example, for OpenIDL nodes, it's openidl.org. In your case, you may use your company domain name as a root, if you like to. Okay, thank you, Janku. And are there any more questions?
Well, it was well timed, gentlemen. I think we're coming up on the next iteration of this for those that couldn't join this session.
Yeah.
If you'd like stick around for a second run, you're more than welcome to. But that was the end of today's kickoff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Like thank you, everybody. Tomorrow we have office hours. Wednesday is the next part of the workshop. And we have office hours on Thursday as well. I'd like to thank everybody for showing up today. This is really, really exciting for us at OpenIDL, but we're really psyched to see you all here.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Hey, Satish, welcome.
Thank you. I caught the end of it, but I'm good. I'm going to look at the recording.
Okay.
Okay, well, we're going to stick around in case anybody else shows up for the second hour. But yeah, the recording will be posted in a little bit.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Okay, I'll stop sharing.
Sure, if you want
to stop now, sharing. And then I'll reshare, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to pause the recording.